Akatra Foundation presents the Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome. You know, when we think of Gandhi, we often see the icon, the statue, the face on the currency. But what if the actual man was, well, far more complex, maybe even contradictory, someone constantly learning, evolving?
Exactly. And admitting huge mistakes, what he himself called Himalayan blunders.
That's what we're diving into today using Ramachandra Guha's incredible book, Gandhi, The Years That Changed the World. It's less a simple biography, more a journey that strips away the myth, doesn't it?
It really does. Guha gives you this profoundly human figure, and our mission here is to get under the skin of that figure during his most pivotal years, 1915 to 1948.
So after his time in South Africa.
Right. Guha asks, how did this middle-aged lawyer become a global icon? Someone who, you know, challenged the world's biggest empire while trying to reshape his own society from the inside out. That's the core question.
And we want to pull out those key insights, those surprising moments Guha uncovers that make Gandhi's story still feel so relevant for you today.
And Guha is definitely the person to guide us. He's one of India's top historians.
Known for deep research, but also writing that you can actually, you know, read and enjoy.
Absolutely. This book, the second volume after Gandhi, before India, draws on research from, I think, four continents. Gives you this incredibly rounded view, warts and all. No head geography here.
Okay, let's get into the journey itself. 1915, Gandhi returns to India. But Guha points out he doesn't just leap into politics. There's a pause.
A very deliberate one. His mentor, Gokhale, gave him some really crucial advice. Spend the first year just traveling.
Seeing the country again.
Yes, but specifically by third-class train. To really see India, the real India, through the eyes of ordinary people, Guha stresses this wasn't tourism. It was about building empathy, grounding himself before acting. A kind of pilgrimage, almost.
And then, from about 1917, he starts these, Guha calls them laboratories for his ideas, particularly Satyagraha.
That's right, truth force. These early campaigns were critical testing grounds. Guha really unpacks them, like Champaran in 1917.
The indigo farmer.
Exactly. He was championing them against British planters. It was about applying those methods he'd honed in South Africa, but, you know, adapting them to Indian soil.
And then Ahmedabad.
The mill strike in 1918. That's where he undertook his first major public fast in India, testing the power of self-suffering. And Kedah, also in 18, supporting peasants facing crop failure, collective civil disobedience.
So Guha shows him experimenting, refining this method.
Systematically, learning with each step. It wasn't just random protest.
And Guha argues these local campaigns were what really built his reputation, right?
Right.
Transformed him from this, well, expatriate figure into a national leader.
Absolutely. It wasn't about seeking fame. It was about building genuine grassroots connections, testing his philosophy. And Guha says this groundwork, this trust, was essential for what came next in the 1920s.
Which were incredibly turbulent years. This is when Gandhi really steps onto the national stage as the Mahatma. The backdrop is the Rowlatt Act in 1919, wasn't it? Very repressive.
Draconian, yes. And Gandhi calls for a nationwide hartal, a strike. Opposition flares up everywhere.
And then the horror of Jallianwala Bagh.
Yeah, the massacre in Amritsar, British troops firing on unarmed civilians.
Yeah.
Guha explains how that event just solidified public anger and really propelled Gandhi into the leadership of the Congress. It led directly to the non-cooperation movement in 1920-22.
Which was huge. Millions boycotting British goods, courts, schools.
Unprecedented scale.
Yeah.
And remarkable Hindu-Muslim unity at that point, partly through the Khilafat issue alliance.
But then came Charichara in 22. Violence broke out.
Right. Protesters killed policemen. And Gandhi makes this incredibly controversial decision, which Guha examines closely, to call off the entire movement.
Just like that. When it seemed to be gaining so much ground.
Exactly. Many followers were stunned, felt it was a massive setback. Another Himalayan blunder, maybe? But Guha argues it shows Gandhi's absolute, almost rigid commitment to nonviolence.
The means had to be pure.
For Gandhi, yes. He truly believed that violence, even from his own side, would poison the struggle and the freedom they eventually won.
That must have been an immensely difficult call. Guha delves into the personal struggle behind that.
Oh, absolutely. Guha shows the internal conflict, the disappointment from his followers, the feeling of a missed opportunity. But for Gandhi, it was a moment for deep reflection. It reinforced his belief. Impure means lead to an impure Swaraj, an impure freedom.
And after that, he shifts focus, doesn't he? Mid-20s, the constructive program.
Right. And Guha makes a key point here. This wasn't a retreat. It was Gandhi realizing you couldn't have real political freedom without tackling India's internal social problems at the same time.
So things like promoting khadi.
Yes, the hand-spun cloth, to boost village economies, self-reliance, and crucially, campaigning tirelessly against untouchability. These weren't side projects for him. Guha shows they were foundational for true Swaraj national independence and individual self-rule, freedom from society's own chains.
Okay, so building on that, the 1930s arrive, and Gandhi is back at the forefront. This brings us to perhaps his most iconic moment, the Dandi Salt March in 1930. Guha really unpacks this, doesn't he? Why was making salt so powerful?
It was strategic genius, according to Guha. Salt was something everyone needed, a basic necessity taxed by the British, so protesting the salt tax resonated across all classes.
A unifying issue.
Perfectly chosen.
And the act itself, walking to the sea, making salt, was inherently nonviolent, symbolic. It generated massive participation and, crucially, global attention. Guha mentions the Time magazine cover. It put the British in a bind. How do you react violently to people making salt without looking tyrannical?
Brilliant. But the 30s also saw major internal conflicts, especially that clash with Dr. B.R. Ambedkar. Yes, the leader of the Dalits, then called the depressed classes. Guha presents this as a fundamental, deeply painful disagreement.
More than just politics.
Oh, much more. It was philosophical. Ambedkar fiercely challenged Gandhi's approach to caste. He argued that trying to reform Hinduism from within wasn't enough, that it actually perpetuated oppression.
And this came to a head over separate electorates.
Exactly. Separate political representation for Dalits. Gandhi opposed this, fearing it would permanently divide Hindu society. It led to his fastened death in prison.
Which resulted in the Pune Pact of 1932.
Right, a compromise. But the core disagreement remained. Guha frames it as this deep chasm. Gandhi seeking moral transformation within Hinduism versus Ambedkar advocating for separate rights, political power, and ultimately conversion out of Hinduism. A conflict, Guha suggests, that still echoes in India.
And after this intense period, Gandhi actually steps back from formal Congress leadership for a while.
He does. He focuses intensely on the anti-untouchability campaign, using the term Harijan Children of God, and on village reconstruction. Again, Guha emphasizes that for Gandhi, this social work wasn't secondary. It was integral to building a truly free India.
Then comes World War II, a huge dilemma for the independence movement.
A massive one. How could India fight for democracy abroad while being denied it at home? Guha shows this led to the Quit India movement in 1942.
Gandhi's most radical call yet.
Yes, his do-or-die speech demanding immediate independence. The British response was swift and harsh mass arrests, the entire Congress leadership jailed.
And during this imprisonment in the Aga Khan Palace, Gandhi suffers immense personal losses.
It's heartbreaking. Guha recounts the deaths of his longtime secretary and close confidant, Mahadev Desai, and then his wife, Kasturba.
Guha really brings out the human cost, doesn't he?
He does. He paints this poignant picture of deep personal grief amidst the political turmoil. It underscores the sacrifices involved, not just for Gandhi, but for those closest to him. Yet even then, Guha notes his quiet resolve, his reliance on spiritual practice.
Then the war ends. Independence is finally on the horizon, 1945-47, but it's overshadowed by the looming tragedy of partition. Guha calls it the agony of freedom.
Such a fitting phrase. The dream of a united India, which Gandhi had championed his entire life, was crumbling. Guha documents those torturous negotiations, the escalating violence.
And Gandhi's growing marginalization.
Yes, as leaders like Nehru and Patel felt compelled, very reluctantly, to accept partition as unavoidable. It was a devastating blow to Gandhi's core vision.
Yet in this period, Guha describes Gandhi's finest hour, walking through riot-torn Noakhali in Bengal.
A 77-year-old man, walking barefoot from village to village, trying to stop the horrific communal killing. A one-man boundary force, as the governor general called him. It showed his incredible courage and commitment, even when his political power was waning.
Guha captures the profound anguish, doesn't he? Political victory, independence, but at the cost of his deepest ideals.
Exactly. It was a personal and ideological defeat amidst the political triumph. He saw the division and violence as a failure of his life's work, a betrayal of nonviolence and unity. His efforts in Noakhali and later in Bihar and Calcutta were desperate attempts to heal the wounds, appealing directly to people's conscience.
So if we try to distill his core philosophy, Guha really insists we have to look at the public and private together, right? These experiments with truth.
absolutely central to Guha's analysis. His fasting, his vow of brahmacharya or celibacy, his diet, even spinning cloth daily, these weren't just quirks. Guha shows they were his way of building inner strength, atma shakti, soul force, which he believed was essential for the political struggle.
So Swaraj wasn't just national independence.
No, it was also individual self-rule, self-control, self-purification. His politics flowed directly from his personal ethics. It was all one continuous experiment in living truthfully.
And Satyagraha itself, was it a fixed doctrine?
Not at all. Guha makes that clear. It was dynamic, flexible, a science in the making, as Gandhi called it. He adapted it constantly. South Africa, Champaran, the Salt March, they all required different applications.
But always requiring immense discipline.
Huge discipline and strategic thinking. It wasn't passive. Guha quotes him, "Nonviolence is the greatest force. A weapon not of the weak, but of the brave and the strong." He was always testing its boundaries.
And this deep conviction that political freedom and social reform had to go hand in hand.
Yes, Guha stresses this constantly. Gandhi believed India couldn't be truly free if it remained enslaved by its own social evils, like untouchability or communal hatred. For him, tackling those was arguably more important than just kicking out the British.
Which makes the eventual partition even more tragic from his perspective.
Profoundly tragic. But it highlights the sheer depth of his vision for a just society, even if reality fell short.
Now, Guha is clear this isn't a hagiography. He shows us a very human Gandhi, flaws and all.
Definitely. Guha discusses his stubbornness, sometimes an authoritarian streak within his ashram and family, and the toll it took, especially on his wife Kasturba and his sons.
Kasturba emerges as quite a figure in her own right in Guha's account.
She really does. Not just a passive wife, but someone with quiet strength, immense fortitude, a partner in protest at times who endured enormous hardship. Guha gives her agency often missed in other accounts.
And Guha doesn't shy away from the later, more controversial experiments, particularly around celibacy.
No, he addresses them directly. Things that disturbed many followers then and remain debated now. But Guha connects them back to this idea of relentless, transparent struggle.
His greatness wasn't perfection, but the striving.
Exactly. That's Guha's point. Gandhi himself said, "I am not a saint, but a humble seeker after truth." And that public grappling with his own ideals, his own flaws, is part of what makes him so compelling and, well, human.
He also wasn't working in isolation. Guha shows him constantly engaging, debating, sometimes clashing with other major figures.
A real cauldron of ideas. We've talked about Ambedkar, that fundamental conflict over caste, representing, as Guha says, an unresolved conflict in Indian society, a clash of two giants.
And Muhammad Ali Jinnah. Guha tracks his journey very carefully.
Yes, from being called an ambassador of Hindu-Muslim unity in earlier years to becoming Gandhi's main political rival and the driving force behind Pakistan. Guha portrays this as a complex, painful process for Gandhi, rooted in political disillusionment and differing visions. It symbolized the ultimate failure of Gandhi's lifelong quest for unity.
Then you had his key lieutenants within Congress, Nehru and Patel.
Loyal, yes, but with distinct visions. Guha shows Gandhi often mediating between Nehru, the socialist, internationalist, modernizer, and Patel, the pragmatic, nationalist organizer focused on party discipline and administration. Their dynamics shaped early independent India.
And even figures outside politics, like the poet Rabindranath Tagore.
Right. Guha details their famous, very respectful disagreements. Tagore worrying about the dangers of nationalism, while Gandhi championed it. Tagore questioned the burning of foreign cloth during non-cooperation as irrational, while Gandhi saw it as vital symbolism. These debates show the intellectual vibrancy of the era.
Okay, let's move towards the end. Independence comes in 1947, but it's a partitioned India. Guha paints Gandhi as heartbroken.
Utterly heartbroken. His life's work for unity seemed in ruins. Guha details his final major fast in Delhi, January 1948. Not against the British anymore, but pleading for communal peace between Hindus and Muslims in the newly independent capital and urging the Indian government to release funds owed to Pakistan.
A fast aimed at his own people.
Yes. And Guha describes it as a monumental success in chaining Delhi back towards sanity, at least temporarily. But it took a huge toll on him.
And then just days later, January 30th, 1948, assassination.
By Nathuram Godse. A Hindu extremist who blamed Gandhi for partition and for being too conciliatory towards Muslims. But Guha argues his death wasn't a failure.
How so?
He frames it as the ultimate sacrifice for the pluralistic, tolerant India Gandhi envisioned. The shock of his murder, Guha suggests, actually helped pull India and Pakistan back from the brink of all-out civil war. His martyrdom cemented his message in a way perhaps his continued life could not have.
So, stepping back from the narrative, what are the big takeaways Guha offers for you, the listener, today?
Well, first, there's leadership and conflict resolution. Guha shows Gandhi leading by example, taking responsibility, believing utterly in dialogue, his Satyagraha principles, respecting the opponent's humanity while fighting injustice that's incredibly relevant, isn't it? From boardrooms to international relations.
And the constructive program. All that grassroots work.
A powerful lesson highlighted by Guha. Real change often starts small, from the ground up. Village sanitation, economic self-reliance, tackling social prejudice. It's a reminder for anyone involved in social change today.
Then there's the personal integrity aspect.
Huge. Gandhi's life as an open book, trying to live his values publicly. Guha contrasts this with, you know, the spin and fake news of our times. His insistence on satya, truth, and consistency. My life is my message. Be the change. These aren't just slogans. Guha shows how deeply Gandhi tried to live them.
And in our polarized world, his fight against religious division seems more urgent than ever.
Absolutely. Guha's account of his unwavering commitment to pluralism, to empathy, even when faced with horrific violence, that offers a potential path, or at least a vital aspiration, for navigating our own divides.
Though Guha is also honest about the limits.
Yes, crucially. He acknowledges that while nonviolence worked powerfully against the British state, it couldn't prevent the mass intercommunity slaughter during partition, a sobering reminder of the immense challenge of deep-seated hatreds.
So thinking about Guha's overall assessment, perhaps Gandhi's biggest legacy wasn't a specific political win.
But demonstrating a different way to politics.
Yeah.
That's what Guha seems to suggest. Pursuing power through service, change through example, maintaining hope and dignity against the odds.
It leaves you thinking.
It certainly does. And maybe a final question for you to consider. In your own life, in your own world, how could you apply Gandhi's spirit of experiments with truth? How might you work to align your own ethics with creating a more just, more humane world around you?
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekhatra Foundation.